And if you're visiting with us, we are so happy that you're here, and we'd love for you to be part of our church family. We're a church that strives to just serve the community, to love God and love each other. So we're really glad that you're with us this morning. And if you have any questions, you can talk to me. I'm wearing the yellow shirt, so it's obvious. I save it because I can't wear it until Easter. I know that one rule. You can't wear bright colors and no white after Labor Day. Those are the two fashion rules that I know. What? Apparently not in California. So I'm now down to only one fashion rule. We are so glad that you're with us. If you're visiting, please get to know someone around. Talk to a member here, and talk to me. Talk to someone to get to know about our church. We'd love to have you. We'd love to have you as part of our church family. We having some issues behind me, but we're all good. So when I started dating my wife, Mandy, I would have told you that I really liked movies. I told people that I liked movies, but she soon realized that I didn't like movies. She was very, very disappointed, and she asked me about all the movies that I hadn't seen. I've talked to you about all, there's a long list, but now she's kind of given me a movie education. I've seen all 12 Harry Potters. I've seen all of them, and I even watched Forrest Gump recently because I hadn't seen that before. I know, it's shocking. She doesn't believe me that I did because I was home on Monday. Monday's my day off, and so I was home watching it, and I was like, I might as well just watch it myself, and I was sitting there crying myself, and she literally walked in as the feather was dropping, and she's like, I don't believe that you watched that. And I said, I really did. I really did. You have to believe me. And one of the reasons why I don't love movies is, A, they're expensive and I'm cheap, but B, I kind of see a lot of times it's just the same story again and again. You know, like whether it's a guy or girl, the hero is kind of struggling to make it through the movie, and just when they're to like their last ounce of strength, somehow they're able to overcome the odds. I mean, whether it's Batman like breaking his back and then able to come back and win in the end, or whatever it is, you have that moment where it's like, okay, it looks like they're not going to win, or you have a nerd at a high school. And this nerd somehow like overthrows the powers in the high school and is able to overcome in the end and get the girl. Now, I wonder if there's a reason why we like those kinds of movies. I think that there is. I think that we like stories of redemption. We like it when someone's down to their last ounce of strength and they're able to overcome and be victorious at the end. We like stories of redemption. So we'll go to the movies and we'll pay $15 or $20 in 3D. And we'll watch the same kind of story over and over again where it's like this person gets their last ounce of strength and they're able to overcome in the end. And you see that in movies, but you also see it in songs. There's a song by Florence and the Machine, and they it is a group and not just a person and a machine, but she sings this song. She says, regrets collect like old friends. Here do we live your darkest moments. I can see no way. I can see no way. And all the ghouls come out to play. It's a lot funner song when it's sung. And every demon wants his pound of flesh, but I like to keep some things to myself. I like to keep my issues drawn. It's always darkest before the dawn. You see, in movies or in songs, you see that we're kind of hopeful for redemption. We're hopeful that, you know, things may be dark now. Things may look difficult now, but there's going to be a dawn. I think that generally in our culture, in our society, we like that theme. We like that idea. But do we really believe that it's possible? And we go to movies and we eat a huge tub of popcorn and we watch Batman come back or Superman come back and win in the end. And we kind of clap and applaud and think, wow, that was really great. But we walk out kind of unchanged. We walk out, and it's hard to change things about ourselves. We kind of fall into patterns and rhythms. I'm the worst. I've had the same haircut since like seventh grade, and I'm scared to change it because why mess with what works? And it's kind of hard. You fall into these rhythms and patterns and routines, and so we go and we watch these movies or we sing these songs about this redemption that's possible. Like maybe I could change something about my life. Maybe there's this part of my life that's kind of dark, and I wish that I could change it, but I just can't. I think the message of Scripture and really the message of Easter is that redemption is possible, that change is possible. And the reason for that is because of God's great love for us. And if we'll let that be the center of our lives, if we'll let that be what defines us, the possibilities are limitless. Back in the Old Testament, in Lamentations chapter 3, verses 22 and 23, one of my favorite verses, it says, "Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed, for his compassions never fail. They're new every morning. Great is your faithfulness." Let's say that together. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed, for his compassions never fail. They're new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. Great is your faithfulness because of the Lord's great love. The thing that might define you now doesn't have to define you forever. Because every morning there's a new dawn. Every morning God's love is offered to you. Every morning God's great faithfulness is an option. And some of us deal with different addictions, different struggles. Some of us have had a tragedy or something that has gone on in our life, and it's just something we really can't get past. Some of us are addicted to lying. Some of us are addicted to ourselves. Some of us are addicted to food. Some of us are addicted to even good things like exercise, and we make those things kind of the priority. We make that the center of our lives, so it's tough for us to move forward. It's tough for us to have that redemption moment. It's tough for us to be like that moment in the movie when you have just a little bit of strength left and you just can't seem to get past that one thing. But Scripture tells us God's great love never fails. That God's great love for us is new every single morning. Every day when you wake up, when you hear your alarm clock, God's grace is available to you. God's great love is available to you. His mercies are failure proof. I think a story that illustrates this so well is in the ministry of Jesus in John chapter 8, verses 1 through 11. But Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. At dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say?" They're using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. So it's very interesting. This story starts with that word that comes up throughout Scripture. At dawn, this event happens. It happens in the temple courts. This woman is brought before Jesus. And what these religious leaders are doing is they're just trying to trap Jesus. They're trying to put him into an impossible situation and make him choose. And they really do make it an impossible situation, because in the law, they're commanded in the Old Testament, this is what you do. It's punishment for sin. And so they want to trap Jesus. But Jesus also is living at a time when Rome is in charge. And Roman law did not say to do that to such women. And so he is presented with this impossible situation. Do I follow what the Old Testament has taught? Do I follow what's been taught forever? Or do I follow Rome? What am I supposed to do? I mean, this is just one of those kind of impossible moments that Jesus is thrust into, and he has to make a choice. And so the interesting part of this, too, is it's in the temple court. So it's around the temple where many Jews would have been, and these are Jewish leaders, and they're waiting to see, like, okay, how can we mess with Jesus? How can he, like, do something wrong? What can we do to accuse him? And so they're in the temple, and, like, Jews would have been walking by, but also this is right next to the Praetorium. The temple was located right next to the Praetorium, which is a Roman military base. And the Praetorium was built just a few feet higher than the temple, basically to say to the people who were worshiping God, they said, you know, you can go and you can worship your God. That's okay with us, us Romans. You can go and worship your God. That's all right. But just so you know, the military base is right here, and it's just a little bit taller than the temple, just to kind of remind the Jews who are worshiping, you can go and do your little sacrifices and worship your little God. That's fine with us. But we're really in charge. And so in this moment, in this scene, you have the temple courts right here, and then Rome kind of watching over Jesus' shoulder. And so he has this impossible situation. Am I supposed to follow Rome, or am I supposed to follow the Jewish law? What am I supposed to do? And both groups would have been watching intently to see what he would have done. And this really is an impossible situation to be in. Kind of reminds me of an impossible moment that I had in my life. I told this story a few years ago, but it just fits this so well. I was home from school one day, and I decided that I was just kind of tired of going to school for a little bit, so I tricked my parents, said I was sick, and did the one thing they can't test, which is saying that you had a stomach problem, so don't do that, kids. But I did that, and then I was hanging out at home, and I was just, after a few hours, this is before the internet and before DVR and all that stuff, so you can only watch so much Judge Judy before you get a little bit bored. And after The Price is Right is over, there's not a lot of exciting TV. And so I'm kind of bored, just sitting there watching these TV shows. And I just thought, you know what would be fun? If I just walk down to the baseball card store, it's just at the end of the street. No one will even know. It'll be fine. I'll get some cards, hopefully score some good ones, and then I'll just get right back. It won't be a problem. So I go down to the baseball card store, and everything's going fine. Open up my pack. Just hanging out with the guy who owned the store for a minute, and he's probably wondering why I was there, but he was all right with it because I was paying him $1.50 or whatever, so he's good. And at this moment, I see the door open to the baseball card store, and in walks a teacher who taught with my mom. She was a teacher at the middle school, and at that moment, I had an impossible thing to figure out, right? I mean, what am I supposed to do? Because there's no way out the back of the shop. So my choices were both bad. I mean, either I go and turn myself into him or I try to run. And of course, I tried to run. I figured that he was like there to buy something else. So I just hit the deck. And I'm just crawling around on the floor, and there's a huge box of comic books that's kind of in the middle, and so I crawled around one side of the comic books, and I see, I peek out, and he's on that side, and I was like, okay, he's on that side, so maybe I can go the other way. So I crawl to the other side of the comic books, and I peer out again, and he's there too. So I'm like, I think this whole thing is up. I don't think I have any hope in this situation. So then I just am kind of like looking around on the floor doing some things, and I took my glasses off and set them on the ground. And then he walks up and says, Brian, what were you doing on the ground? And I said, oh, I was just looking for my glasses. I'm sorry, they fell. And I got to put them back on. And then he casually was just like, well, what'd you get in your baseball card pack? And we have this conversation. I think maybe like he's cool, you know, maybe he's not going to turn me in. Like it's fine. But of course, when mom got home, it was not a pretty situation for me because I had been found out. And for years, it bugged me. Why did he walk into that store? He didn't even buy anything. And then I finally realized, like, oh, he just saw me walking in. Of course. I don't know why I was so struggling with why he was there. But I remember that moment, and you probably do too, when you have an impossible situation. Like there's maybe two groups or both decisions that you have are bad. You're like, which one should I choose? I can choose that way. I can choose to try and duck, which probably isn't going to work, or I can go just turn myself in. Neither of them are very good. So Jesus is faced here with an impossible circumstance, an impossible situation. Are you going to side with Rome? Or are you going to side with the Jews? What are you going to do? And Jesus does something very interesting. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger, which is kind of a weird move, isn't it? And most of the time when you see what Jesus does, you know, I see the point, I know why he did that. But this is kind of an interesting move, isn't it? He just bends down. You can imagine this scene. People are gathered there. And let's say that this woman is over here, and he just begins to write in the sand. And it's such a strange thing. It just, What are you doing? What are you writing? What's going on? Why would you do this? I think there's a reason that Jesus does this. And if you're not a believer in Jesus, I'm so glad that you're with us today. But one thing that you have to admit if you're not a believer is that Jesus is constantly doing brilliant things. He's doing things that are kind of outside the box. Like, this is not what I would have done in this situation. If I had an impossible situation, my first move is probably like, okay, I'm going to answer this. Or I'm going to duck and run away, see what can happen. I'm going to do something else. But he just starts to write in the sand. And I think when you really think about it, it makes total sense. Because think for a minute about this woman. It says that literally in the Greek there, she is literally caught in the act of adultery. So caught in the act. So think about what she looks like right now. I mean, she may not have many clothes on, maybe what she was able to grab on her way out. She's sitting there just desperate for the eyes to be off of her. And think about this too. She's just a prop in this story. They're just using her as a trap. I mean, the Pharisees, they just see this woman as like a mouse or cheese to a mouse, just trying to put this woman in this trap. So then Jesus will have to make a decision. I mean, the act of adultery, usually it takes two to tango on that. I mean, why didn't they bring the guy too? I mean, it's just her. And she's sitting there in this moment. Who knows how much she's wearing? Who knows what she looks like? And Jesus bends down to write in the sand, which is a brilliant, brilliant thing to do. Because can you just think about the crowd there? They all want this answer. They want him to say something. And he bends down and starts to write in the sand. So what Jesus is doing is what she needs more than anything in this moment. The eyes now come off of her, and they're on to him. Can you see the crowd? They're waiting for this answer, and then he just starts to stall. And you see them like kind of looking over their shoulder, like, what's he doing? What's he writing? You see them moving their eyes from her to him. I mean, right away, what a gracious act. Jesus does exactly what this woman would want more than anything else, to get even just for a moment the eyes off of her and on to him. And imagine if like your greatest moment of shame was just broadcast for everybody. Like every week we came together, and if anybody sinned, which we all do, we had to like walk up and just like put it on the screen, like, here's what I did this week, and we'd all just kind of stare and awkwardly look at each other. And this is this woman's moment of greatest shame. And maybe your moment of greatest shame happened in front of a few people or a few friends. But for her, she has this shame played out in front of everyone. And so Jesus begins to write in the sand. And the eyes move from her to him. And for just a moment, she gets to put herself together or just get something right. And just for that moment, not everyone is staring at her. They start to look at him. And then after he's done some writing, he stands up and he says this. When they kept on questioning him, which kind of shows us that he might have been writing in there for a while, maybe played some tic-tac-toe or something, and they keep on questioning him, he straightens up and says, "Let any of you who without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. So he says, "Let anyone who's without sin cast a stone." This reminds me of a great moment in The Simpsons where they say, "If anyone's without sin, let them cast the first stone." And the Flanders boys, who are perfect in that show, they're like, "Can I do it or can you?" They're like trying to figure it out, which is just a great picture of how religious people are. So thank you to The Simpsons. They're like, can I throw it or can you? But these men, there's no perfect ones there. And so you can kind of imagine the stones dropping. And it says the older ones first, because as you get a little older, you realize just how many mistakes you've made. So they begin to drop their stones and they walk away. Again, what a brilliant thing that Jesus does here. And how would you come up with this? How would you say that in this moment? I mean, it's like combining MacGyver and Jack Bauer. I mean, two people who always know the right thing to do. They always know, okay, we have just a few minutes and we need to do this, or MacGyver has just the right amount of stuff and he somehow coaxes his way out of the situation. And Jesus is just so brilliant here. He says, if any of you are without sin, go ahead. Go ahead. And they all walk away. And imagine that this woman who's had all of this shame heaped upon her, all of this guilt for what she's done. And again, we don't know what she's wearing, what she looks like. She now is face to face with Jesus. And he says this, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." Can you imagine just how she felt in that moment? And unsure if she's going to die, unsure about what Jesus is going to do, and when she comes face to face with Jesus, she realizes just how deep his love is for her. And can you just imagine that with all the faces that she's seen that day, all the condemnation, all the things that people have said to her, maybe she was dragged through town, all the people who looked and said, "Oh, there goes another woman like that," all the things that have happened to her on that day, all the faces that she's seen, and now she sees the face of Jesus. And can you see the way he looked at her? The way he loved her? Can you see the way that he said, "Go now, I don't condemn you either"? This is where I believe that life change begins, that redemption truly begins. If you can see the face of Jesus right here, if you can see the way that he speaks to you, the way that he loves you, this grace that's new for you every single morning, even in your moments of great shame, when you do that thing again and again and again, you just can't seem to get past it. Jesus looks right at her, says, "I don't condemn you. So go and leave your life of sin." If we can just grab hold of this kind of power, if we can just grab hold of this kind of life that Jesus says to us every single day, you are forgiven, you are loved, that every morning we could have a dawn. Because God's mercy is new for us every single morning. Where is it in your life that you need a dawn? Where is it that you need a new hope, new direction? Where is it that you need Jesus to look at a certain part of your life and say, "Neither do I condemn you. You aren't condemned. You're loved." This kind of thing, if we can just grasp it, can change our lives and our directions forever. There's a great story about a man named Louis Zamperini. Here's a picture of Louis. I think he's 96 now. He has an absolutely amazing story. It was written about in the book Unbroken by Laura Hillenbrand, which I would recommend. Please go and read this book. It's the author of Seabiscuit, and she wrote this book about him as well, and it's a fantastic book. It's so good that they're turning it into a movie on December 25th, 2014. It's going to come out, and Angelina Jolie's directing it, so I would read the book before the movie. It could be good, could be bad. I'm not really sure, but read the book first because the book's always better than the movie. And Louis Zamperini, Angelina Jolie actually read this book and said, "Where is this guy? It's such an amazing story. I have to get to know him a little bit." And she realized that he had a home in the Hollywood Hills not too far away from her. And so she went and met him and wanted to make this movie about his life because his life has been absolutely unbelievable. As a young man, he was 18. He competed in the 1936 Olympics. And he got to shake Hitler's hand. This was before Hitler became Hitler. He got to know him through that. And he was a young man, and he was a sprinter. And he didn't actually win a medal in the Olympics, but because of how young he was, he became a huge celebrity back in the States. And so he did that and was still running, but then World War II happened, and he enlisted for World War II and was a bomber in World War II. And his plane, as he was in a battle, went down in the Pacific. And he was on a raft for 47 days, just floating out in the Pacific. He tells stories about a huge shark that came and tried to get him off the raft, but luckily he survived. So after 47 days, he washes up and finds somebody to rescue him, but turns out it's not a rescuer. It's some people from Japan who put him into a prison camp. And they tortured him for 2 years. And because his name was kind of famous, they knew who he was, they tortured him even more, including there was one guy who they called the Bird, who took a lot of pleasure in torturing Louis Zamperini. So he would go and torture Louis every single day for 2 years. So finally, Louis was released, and he was able to come back. But that kind of stuff doesn't leave you very easily, obviously. So he had some serious issues with post-traumatic stress syndrome, and he was having nightmares every single night. And his wife and his relationship were really on the rocks. It was kind of going south, and she said, you know, if we're going to stay married, you have to come with me to hear this guy, Billy Graham. And if you come with me, then let's see what message Billy might have for you. And here's a picture of Billy Graham and Louis Zamperini. You can tell kind of how old that picture is based on how Billy Graham looks. And it was at a tent meeting in Los Angeles that Louis Zamperini heard about the forgiveness of God. And this story is told, a lot of the sermon is actually included in the book by Laura Hillenbrand. So again, please, I know the story is amazing. Go check it out. He heard about this forgiveness, and it touched deep inside of him. He'd never heard this message before. And so on that night, he committed his life to following Christ, and his whole life switched upside down. And he said he had had nightmares basically every single night after going through the torture and what he went through in Japan. But that night, after hearing Billy Graham for the first time, he never had a nightmare again. He's now 96. And not only did he receive this grace and was he touched by it, but he was so touched by it that he said, you know, I want to go back and I want to talk to the people who tormented me, who tortured me. I want to tell them about the forgiveness that I've received, and I want to tell them that I've forgiven them as well. So he went to Japan and he met with all the people that they could gather together. And he told them, I just want to tell you, you tortured my life for a long time, but I don't hate you anymore. You are forgiven just like I've been. And they weren't able to find the guy, the Bird, who they said had tortured him more than anything, but he wrote a letter in case he was ever found and said the same message, that he was forgiven. And eventually, they found him. So Louis Zamperini, his life was touched by grace. I think it's so interesting that this guy had lived such an amazing life up to this point. And he'd been in the Olympics. He was out on a raft. He spent time in a prison camp. He did more in his first 30 years than I think I'm going to do in my entire life. He'd been such he'd been a man that had been through so much in so many ways. But even for him, a new dawn was possible. Even for him, when he was touched by the grace of God, it moved in him so much that he just couldn't keep it to himself. It changed the way that he lived forever. Where do you need this new dawn? Where do you need this hope of God to stir in your heart? Because the good news is, if you're just hearing this message for the first time, or if you've heard it 1,000 times maybe, we need this message again and again and again, because God's grace, love, and mercy is new for us every single morning. People who have been part of this church or Christians for a long time, they aren't better than anybody else. We're just people who have experienced this grace again and again and again. Where do you need a new dawn? Because the good news is, as much as we yearn for redemption, as much as we hope and see in movies and culture and all ways that we're hoping for this redemption, the good news of the gospel is redemption is possible. And it starts by really seeing the face of Jesus and understanding that we don't live in condemnation anymore. And all those people who wanted to throw stones walk away. So where do you need a new dawn? I wanted to finish this morning with a visible reminder of the fact that we can experience a dawn. And so we're going to sing a couple songs. We're going to dim the lights for these next couple songs. And then we'll bring them back up and stand together to celebrate the fact that a new dawn is possible for all of us. That a new dawn is very real. That God's grace and mercy is new for us every single day. So stay seated as we sing these next two songs, and we'll dim the lights, and we'll bring the lights back up together, and we'll close with one final song.